Every year, farms all over the country receive billions of dollars in federal funding through the Farm Bill. And most of that money ends up going to farmers who grow the biggest commodity crops. And you can probably guess what's on that list. Corn, soybeans, cotton. You know what's not on the list? Chard, kohlrabi, and kale.
They say kale is the best green that you can eat. It got the most nutrients in it, but me, I prefer Swiss chard. The rainbow colors, you got the purple colors in it, you got the orange, the yellow, so when you bunch them all up in one bunch, it's terrific. Everybody loves it.
Urban farmers, small vegetable farmers, there's been very little money set aside for that kind of small-scale agriculture compared to big row crops. In this episode, we'll talk to some of these urban farmers growing vegetables without a safety net about what the Farm Bill means when you don't fit the traditional mold. From NET, Nebraska's PBS and NPR stations, this is On the Table, a podcast that brings you behind-the-scenes stories of our food system and explains how one law, the Farm Bill, has a surprising influence over what you eat and how it's raised. I'm Grant Gerlach.
So I grew up in a small town called Broken Bow, which is right in the middle of Nebraska, Custer County. A lot of corn, a lot of soybeans, and a lot of cows.
This is Carson Vaughn. He's a freelance journalist who's written for outlets like the New York Times and the Atlantic. He grew up in rural Nebraska, but he's living in Chicago now. So we asked him to talk to some urban farmers to find out how they're surviving in the city. What'd you find out about who's farming in Chicago?
Yeah, well, when you start to look a little bit closer and ask around a little bit, you will find that urban farming is sort of exploding in Chicago. Chicago's urban ag seems very tied up with a lot of, you know, sort of social justice initiatives and things like that. And then, of course, you have your millennial hipsters that are also growing carrots on the roof. So, yeah. You know, it's kind of a mix. Laura Calvert is the executive director of Advocates for Urban Agriculture.
There's farms on rooftops, there's indoor hydroponic and aquaponic systems, so it covers the range, but agriculture has always been a big part with the city, from the stockyards to having one of the largest Victory Gardens during World War II to being a flower capital, the celery capital. So while it feels unusual maybe in this moment, that's really where the city's history is.
Who did you go to talk to about how their farm relates to the Farm Bill?
I went to a group called Growing Home, and essentially they get people who are, you know, having a rough time transitioning between jobs or just need a job to start with. And they do that by getting them onto an urban farm, which they've established in a community called Inglewood on the south side of Chicago. To get out to Inglewood, it's really far south. So you're taking the subway for basically an hour, the L train, an hour outside of what you think of as like downtown urban core of Chicago. And then you're hopping on another bus for another 30 minutes, and then you get off the bus stop, the nearest one, and you walk another three blocks to get to the Growing Home farm in the center of Inglewood. And Inglewood is a community of people, about 65,000, and once was a very vibrant part of Chicago and has since slowly kind of been disinvested and, you know, a little bit disenfranchised, and they don't have great access to food. So we're looking at a community that's fallen on pretty tough times, and right in the middle of it springs this Growing Home urban garden, and yeah. You see these big hoop houses and all these different vegetables.
Here's the farm. This is where everything happens.
Fred Daniels, who is the actually on-site farm director, said they produce 30 to 35,000 pounds of produce a year, and they take all that and they distribute it via farmers markets and communities markets and that kind of thing.
So. We got chard, we got some spinach just went in. It was out of season, but now it's back. We got carrots, we got kale, beets, scallions. Basically every vegetable, we grow it.
They're growing food and they're selling it at farmers markets and things, but that's really just kind of half of what they're trying to accomplish.
Well, so everybody that works for Growing Home, not only are they getting job training and getting their hands in the dirt and learning that, they're also getting paid to work on the farm at the same time. And so, yeah, half of it is them, like, working the farm, getting the harvest out to the markets and whatever, but they're also learning, like, how to apply for other jobs. So it's a job transition and job training program. Fred is a really neat story because Fred grew up in the Englewood area. He's a guy, like most people that come into Growing Home, who had no farming experience, didn't see himself moving into a career in agriculture and all
of a sudden. He didn't see himself as a farmer.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Before coming here, I really didn't pay attention or think about where the food was coming from, you know. Or have a, you know, the knowledge of like what they actually go through and why we should be grateful to have farmers. So now it's like I understand the hard work and the labor that go into producing produce. You get farming like through experience. Like you learn different bugs, you learn about how to rotate your crops and why it's important to rotate your crops. And that's stuff that comes with experience. Like my granny, she had a garden for years and she'd tell me like, hey, I put my tomatoes out and they ain't do nothing this year. And it's like, hey, granny, you put them in the same spot. Like you gotta move them around, you know? So it come with experience. So now she know.
Is she still around?
Mm-hmm.
Has she seen your work here?
Yep.
So, I mean, as somebody who grew up in the neighborhood, like, what impact do you think Growing at Home has on getting people, you know, fresh food and stuff?
It got a big impact on, like, bringing fresh food to the community, but also, like, it's more, like, me, I focus more on, like, the jobs, because that's, like, we creating jobs as well as, like, bringing, you know, healthy food to the community as well. So, because you need money to even buy the food.
Right,
so,
right.
Creating jobs, you know, and doing outreach, bringing more awareness to the farm. That's like what it's all about.
Why did they build a farm for job training? They could have job training without a farm. What is it about farming that they think makes a difference?
Yeah, well, I asked Harry Rhodes, who is the executive director of Growing Home, that exact question. And he said when it first started, the guy who was kind of the brainchild behind Growing Home had some background in farming. And his sort of philosophy on it was that people who are homeless or have experienced homelessness were sort of fundamentally lacking in roots. And his philosophy very literally was, you know, let's get them back to working with the roots. Let's get them in the soil. And so having somebody who's been transient for so long go through this process where they're committed to watching something go from planted in the soil to popping up to harvesting it to take it directly to the consumer, he just thought that whole process, you know, helped them develop that kind of commitment to a cause.
Planting, seeing something grow, and then taking it to market. It's a very powerful experience. And it's not just your typical job training, but they're part of what we do. They're part of the production cycle from day one. And they get paid for the work they do as well as the class time, which is very different from most job training programs.
Rural farmers who grow corn or cotton, they have a lot of support in the Farm Bill. And I was wondering what things look like from the perspective of a place like Growing Home. You know, if you grow corn, you can receive payments when prices fall. You can buy subsidized insurance. Did you get the sense that these urban farmers feel supported by Farm Bill programs?
I would say no. And they, I think, say that sort of reluctantly. They don't want to step on any toes either because the USDA does obviously help out with, you know, some of the SNAP stuff that they're involved with.
But the food stamp programs.
Yeah, exactly.
Laura Calvert from the Advocates for Urban Agriculture said besides SNAP, there are some smaller nutrition programs that indirectly support urban farms, like FINNI, the Food Insecurity and Nutrition Incentive.
That funding has created farmers markets. In Chicago, it's created prescription food programs called, you know, some programs are called VeggieRx, where medical providers are providing prescriptions to fresh fruits and vegetables from local farms. So, you know, it acts as a stimulus to create markets and opens up the access for low-income folks to get the produce.
They would like to see more money that could be directly invested into, you know, promoting the markets, the nutrition, the jobs training program, and then obviously, you know, those very tangible on-site products like the hoop houses and other stuff like that.
Besides just the money that's there, do urban farms feel engaged by the Farm Bill, just, you know, the political process around it?
They feel a little bit pushed to the side, I think, when it comes to the larger Farm Bill debate. You know, they don't feel like they have a huge voice at the table. So when I spoke to Harry Rhodes, he explained that the Farm Bill still feels very lopsided, very catered towards the bigger corporate ag producers than any of these smaller urban farmers.
USDA has always been big on the rural development, and that's farming. And so whenever anyone gets involved, urban farming, and the urban farming needs to have some of that support, they'll say, oh, that's not really farming.
When they can get any sort of voice in there, they're happy to have it, but they're not sitting around waiting for the Farm Bill, you know, designers to come to them and say, what do you think?
They've kind of been making it work without as much direct support.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very grassroots thing. They started on their own, but like I said, they're not going to sit around waiting for some big prize.
We wanted to know just how urban farmers make use of current Farm Bill programs, or at least adapt to them. So we visited Robinette Farms, a farm just outside of Lincoln, Nebraska, where the owners grow fresh produce for city folks.
I'm Alex McKiernan, and I own Robinette Farms.
I'm Chloe Deagle, and I own Robinette Farms. Robinette Farms is primarily a CSA farm.
The way community-supported agriculture works is people pay us in the spring, or at least partially in the spring, for vegetables that they receive during the summer. So they get paid back for that upfront money in vegetables each week.
And we have about 8 acres this year in vegetable production. So we grow probably 35 different varieties of vegetables. So you basically can think about, you know, your garden and your backyard and blow it up to about 8 acres.
The day I arrived, they were sorting and packaging produce for that week's delivery. Inside a red steel shed, tables were lined with crates, all bursting with fresh vegetables, eggs, and cheese.
The choices this week for our members were Napa cabbage, purple potatoes, salad turnips, cucumbers.
One of the reasons Robinette runs a CSA is for financial security, because the Farm Bill doesn't help them the same as a large commodity farmer who's likely to buy federally subsidized crop insurance.
For a long time, there haven't been any ways to interact with the federal government for small farms like us in terms of insurance or crop payments or anything like that. And so a large-scale commodity grower might go to their bank and get an operating loan for the year, and then they plant their crop. And they get crop insurance.
In case something goes bad and there's a storm.
Yeah, in case they get hailed out or there's some problem. And then they have a contract to sell that to somebody. And that contract is locked in far in advance. Those sorts of things don't really happen in vegetable farming. And so that was part of the financial motivation for community-supported agriculture. It's a way for those people to directly interact with us, and on the financial end, for us to have some guaranteed income and income up front when we need to get the season going. And it created that sort of, you know, guaranteed income that commodity farmers might have through federal programs.
When we've talked to row crop farmers about the Farm Bill, there are some specific things that they really feel like they couldn't do without if they weren't in the Farm Bill, like crop insurance or the commodity support programs. Are there equivalents for a smaller vegetable farm like yours?
Well, we would not be able to buy this land if it weren't for Farm Service Agency and their loan options.
What was it like going through that process and getting a USDA loan?
It was interesting. Farms in Nebraska and the FSA, the Farm Service Agency loan infrastructure, they weren't used to farms that look like us, so they didn't really know how to handle us. We got a very small operating loan in 2010 from Farm Service Agency, And at that time, they told us we were the only vegetable operation to ever apply for one. And I remember at one point getting a phone call from the loan agent, and he said, well, I had to bring this up to the state level because we didn't really know how to handle it. And we were talking about it, and someone said, well, this sounds like a contract. Is the CSA, is that a contract? And so he called and asked, is the CSA a contract? And we said, well, yeah, each person agrees to pay a certain amount to get vegetables, so it's a contract. And he said, okay, then we can make this happen. And it was just that we didn't know the words to say to make them understand our business model, and they didn't know the questions to ask.
It wasn't a perfect fit, but they did manage to get the loan that helped them operate their CSA. Since then, McKiernan says the USDA has carved out a microloan program so farmers applying for smaller loans don't have to deal with so much red tape. And they learned there are other programs making tweaks to cater to smaller farms like Robinette. There's one called the Value Added Producer Grant, which used to be targeted mostly at the kind of small businesses someone might start in their kitchen, someone making jelly or salsa or cheese. Chloe Deagle says now it's aimed more broadly at local food.
Gosh, it must have been at one of the farmers markets. One of the women that works at the USDA and helps run the Value Added Producer Grant program said, you guys should apply for this. There's money out there for marketing and paying for signs and all these little things that you guys need, even just at the farmers market, and there's money out there to help you kind of build that.
Anything that's not related to production can be covered by the grant. And you've seen those charts that'll have a picture of a loaf of bread, and they'll say the farmer gets 4 cents out of this loaf of bread or whatever it is. And the VAPG grant, the Value Added Producers Grant, is really about trying to increase the share of the marketing dollar that a farmer gets. And that's expensive because you have to spend time on sales and your image and your website and deliveries and getting out in front of people. And so the VAPG grant is really about trying to help farmers deal with those new marketing expenses as they try to reach customers.
This is one spot where the impact of the 2018 Farm Bill could be felt. The Senate would continue mandatory funding for the value-added program, while the House would leave funding up to annual appropriations from Congress. The concern is that appropriators will take that opportunity to cut Farm Bill spending. In the last Farm Bill, Congress put $63 million into the value-added program.
Obviously, that's a lot of money, but that's a tiny fraction of a fraction of a fraction compared to the whole Farm Bill. And it really supports trying to get farmers building small businesses and not being dependent on the prices that people are willing to pay, that the market will pay. If you cut those, you're really not doing anything to trim the budget of the Farm Bill. You're really just hurting these small businesses that can expand based on them.
When you look at the programs that are out there, do you feel like they fit what you do?
Not directly, but it's changing. I think there's a fair amount of effort at the federal level to try to help this sort of agriculture. And we need to, because again, our farm engages the community directly in agriculture, and they know where their food comes from and how it's produced. And that's an important opportunity for people to learn about agriculture and then expand that knowledge to the rest of the ag system and food production. The other thing is that a lot of rural communities are really dying and people are leaving because it takes less and less manpower per acre to produce the crops that we've produced forever. A farm like ours uses a lot of manpower and on a small amount of land can be very productive. That's a great benefit to small communities and hopefully is business growth in those small rural communities. I hope that they maintain funding for some of these small programs because I know they have an outsized impact for their small budget.
Let's catch up with where things stand with the 2018 Farm Bill. As we explained in our last episode, the current version of the Farm Bill has expired. But Congress is still far from passing a replacement. The House and Senate are at odds on how to combine their separate versions of the bill. And urban farming actually comes into play here. It starts with some proposals in the Senate bill to expand programs aimed at local and regional food systems. Senator Sherrod Brown is one of the lawmakers supporting those ideas. He's a Democrat from Ohio.
For the first time, we provided baseline funding for USDA programs that promote local food production and help small growers increase their revenues and building predictability into the future.
Those changes would also have support from Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, and she is the top Democrat in the Senate Ag Committee, which gives them some clout. But there's a problem. Spending more in one place means taking money from somewhere else. And in this case, the funding for local foods would come from cuts to a rural utility program. And that program is favored by the chair of the House Agriculture Committee, Congressman Mike Conaway, a Republican from Texas. According to Politico, that money for urban farming is one of several points that Conaway and Stabenow have been stuck on. And it's holding back progress on other major holdups, like work requirements for people in the SNAP program. So for now, the Farm Bill stays in limbo. I'm Grant Gerlach, the host of On the Table. We made this episode with producer Marianne Andre, production assistant Carlos Sandoval, and consulting producer Matthew Hodapp. Thanks again to Carson Vaughn for his reporting. Our executive producers are Chad Davis and Dennis Kellogg. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. On the Table is a production of NET, Nebraska's PBS and NPR stations. Thanks for listening.